Okay, we should get started. This lecture on geochemistry, I'm going to try to do three things. One will be to take you through the melting operator that I would call it, which means what we look at the surface are melts of the mantle. What we really want to know about is the mantle, and there's a black box in between the melts and the mantle, and I'm going to guide you through the arcane techniques of going from melts to mantle. Okay, partly that will involve trace elements. We talked about spidergrams last time, so there'll be some spidergram component. The other way we look through this black box is with isotopes, so I'll take you through a little tutorial on isotope evolution, and then we'll focus on a particular isotope system, namely helium, so that you begin to get a feeling for one of the noble gas isotope systems. So let's start by just outlining. Okay, this is a spidergram. You remember this is just a list of a whole bunch of elements in this order of increasing incompatibility. In other words, going this way, looking more and more at trace elements that don't like to be in crystals but prefer to be in melts. Okay, and we showed you this complicated partitioning spidergram where we had things like olivine, CPX, OPX. I've taken out all the wiggles. Okay, and this then is just concentration in the liquid over concentration in the solid. This is the basic information that we need to go through this black box by taking melts going to the source. Let's actually change this then and look at a source and a melt. So this is concentration liquid over. So this would be a basalt, and this would be the concentration in the mantle. So this would be mantle. And melt, something like that, idealized. Okay, and so this black box, however you want to draw the arrows, our basic information comes from this because we have very few samples of the mantle. In particular, in the oceans, you rarely get mantle exposed or even accessible. So, but we have tons and tons of melt. Every volcanic island, almost every island in the ocean is volcanic, and almost every one of those we have basaltic melts. And the real question is, we know, and we'll see later on, we know that this mantle isn't the same every place. It's heterogeneous, and we would like to be able to go from all of these melts, for which we have thousands of samples, to learning something about the mantle that they came from. The longer range problem really is, once we know what the mantle is like for a given area, for a given domain, we then can interrogate that mantle to ask what was its evolution back in time. So it's sort of a series of processes to get back to what tectonic, what mantle dynamic process got us from the very beginning to here. Okay, so there are several black boxes involved. No, this is just some piece of mantle, okay? Apparently so. if it had been primitive Earth, it would look like that, and we almost never see that, and we'll see why. So let me just write a few simple melting equations so you get some feel for what this operator is. So we define something F fraction of melt is the bulk partition coefficient, which you remember is C liquid over C solid, C zero. Let's do it this way. Okay, and bulk simply means we know the mantle's multi-phase. If it was a single phase, we would just be looking at the partition coefficient of that phase. But it's multi-phase, so we have to add up the partition coefficients of every phase. And that's just done very simply the partition coefficient, okay, liquid over solid of phase alpha times its abundance, volume abundance, modal abundance, however you like, phase beta, that for as many phases as you have. So typically we have four or five phases. We know the individual partition coefficients. We have to usually guess at this, but for certain compositions, for example, for this bulk Earth, we know something about the major element composition, which I haven't told you how we know that yet exactly. But you take the major element composition, put it through experimental petrology, black box, to get the modal abundances of the phases. Okay, so the simplest simplest kind of melting is called batch melting. All that means is you take a box of mantle and you melt it by F. So you produce a fraction of melt F. And then simply look at the concentration in that melt. Okay. You want to change F, you simply make more melt and again ask what the concentration looks like in the melt. So it's a continuous equilibrium process. In other words, you assume always that the trace elements are in equilibrium between the melt and the solid. Whether that's true or not is an issue, and there's kinetics embedded in everything I'm going to say, but I'm not going to talk a whole lot about the kinetics, except usually we think this is true, okay? But it may not always be true. So if in this simple system, then concentration of the liquid is really simple, and this is just the mass balance. Okay. Yeah. Sure. But the assumption is, let's say, I mean, D is also a function of pressure, temperature, you know, lots of stuff. Problem is we can't measure D very well. It's usually a pretty small number. For many of these, it's always less than 0.1, sometimes 0.001. And if you can measure it to a factor of 2, you're usually really pretty happy. So, and the dependences on F, P, T composition sort of small relative to how well we measure things. Oh no, there are, of course, compatible elements, things that prefer the crystals. They don't involve the isotope systems. Okay, most of the isotope systems are incompatible elements, so, and all I've showed here are incompatible elements. You could continue this spidergram on over here, adding and going toward compatible elements. But we generally ignore all those. Okay, this is the bulk D, which you've added up out of all the phases. This is the initial concentration in the solid. You can also write this for the concentration in the solid that exists after you've melted, but again, that's just a mass balance.
So the CS that appears in that equation is different from the CS that appears in the definition of D above, is that correct?
No.
B is actually the ratio of what's in the liquid to what's in the solid at any particular time.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yes. Let's do that. Okay. Right.
Well, a couple of points.
This is the instantaneous equilibrium partitioning.
What is that? The D's or the bulk D very slowly with F at small melt pressure.
There's a slightly one step more complicated. This is for what we call modal melting, which means you melt in proportion. You melt the phases in the proportion that they exist in the original solid. Now we know that's not true, okay? And I could write, you can formulate another D, which is called P, which it uses the phases in the proportions that they enter the melt, okay? I was just trying to keep it simple, just to get the principle straight.
Most people, when they do this kind of modeling, they account for changes in the phase proportions in the solid.
Okay, so the two limits you can see sort of right away, that typically D is smaller than 1, so this term looks like 1. As F goes to 0, in other words for very, very small melt fractions, the limit of what you can do in the liquid is just simply 1 over D. So if D is 0.01, partition coefficient 0.01, the most you can get in the liquid is 100 times the solid. Okay. So that's a limit for small f. The limit for large f is obviously C0. You melt the whole thing, you just get back what you started with. Okay. You can write the equation for the residual solid. Since the solid and liquid are in equilibrium, the solid in this box is really just the liquid times D. Is this confusing? Okay, so this is one kind of melting, the really simplest kind. for many, many years, it was the only kind anybody worried about because we didn't know any different. Okay? So there's another kind called fractional melting. Also, in this case, what I'm going to give you is modal fractional melting. And this is defined, go back to our little box. Take an infinitely small amount of melt and equilibrate it with the solid. Okay, and as soon as you do that, you take the melt out and throw it away. In fact, you don't throw it away, you put it up here and collect it in a box. Then you take another infinitesimally small amount of melt, equilibrate it with the whole box, throw it away, take it up here, and store it, mix it together with what you've already got. And so it's very different than batch melting in several ways. So if we want to write then that equation, looks quite a bit different, has F, which now is intended to mean the total amount of melting that you've done up to that point. Okay, so taking all these little infinitesimal fractions of melt and aggregated them, and this is the aggregated liquid. You can rewrite this easily to use the concentration of each incremental melt, each instantaneous melt. But since we don't ever see those melts, we're more interested in what the sum is that we've collected in this box. Okay, so that's what F is. It's the total amount of melting that's occurred here. And of course, at each stage, you basically never have any melt here, because every time you make some, you take it away. There's another more complicated model I'm not going to give you, but because this is a granular rock made up out of minerals with grain boundaries, the concept is perhaps you can't actually get all the melt out. So you make a little melt, but because it's such a low melt fraction, it doesn't escape, and it only escapes when it gets to a certain size. So there may be a sort of standing porosity in this rock at all times. And in fact, what that does to you is gives you something intermediate between this and this. So you sort of have a little batch melting going on all the time. Every time you exceed, let's say, 1% melt, you take it away, but you leave this 1% there as a constant. Doesn't make a huge difference. So we've got a D here. You've got the D here, is the bulk partition coefficient. The limit, interestingly enough, over here, remember we said that C liquid goes to Cs over D. Okay, the limit was we could never get the liquid above 1 over D times the solid. The limit here is in fact exactly the same. So at very small melt fractions, these two things are basically the same. They only differ at higher melt fractions. And I'll draw you a picture in a minute to show you that in fact the liquid compositions don't even, as long as you aggregate these fractional melts, they don't even differ in a substantial way. But what differs dramatically is the solid. Okay, we have this solid here, and I'll show you in a minute. I should give you the solid here as well. I'm sure I give you the right solid. So aggregated liquid, residual solid from fractional melting. Liquid doesn't, it's by definition aggregated and residual solid. So let me just draw. Everybody got this? Can I erase it? Push it up? And I can't reach the top.
Right on the other board.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. That would be. So we're just going to look at the first 10%, okay? 20 years ago, people thought things were running out here to 25% melt, but that's actually pretty rare. Almost all of the action is in this region, okay? And this will be a log scale. To tell you, this is for D 0.01. Okay, this is the D batch partition coefficient. That's sort of relevant to the middle of the spidogram, just to give you some idea of what part of the spidogram we're doing this melting equation for. Okay, so we see again the limit at small, as F goes to zero, you can go in concentration in the melt, the 1 over D, which is 100, so you start at 100. Eventually this, if we go far enough, will approach 1. Okay. So what does the aggregated fractional melt look like? Which is a very different process, you realize. I've even exaggerated the difference here. I mean, it's a log scale, so it is different, but it's of order 30-40% higher. Again, the endpoints are the same. It goes to 1 at high F, starts at 100 at low F. So people were, I mean, it's a really simple-minded thing, but people are really happy to realize that to first order, it didn't matter which model you used. Okay, because there was a big fight going on in the early days. We did batch melting first because it was simple. And then people said, well, we think melting is actually fractional, and then everybody got in a tizzy because they thought that was just going to make their life complicated. And then somebody took the time to actually look at the two equations and go, wow, it's actually not that different. Okay. But what's dramatically different isn't the melt, but the source. So if we look at the batch source, of course, at small f, the source is going to start at 1 because you haven't done any melting. Looks like that. So you get to 10%, and you're roughly factor of 10. Down. In other words, you've decreased the residual mantle concentration by about an order of magnitude. with the batch melting. But if you look at the fractional melting, it drops off really severely. And it drops off depending on D. Okay, if you were to look, for example, at a D of, say, 0.002, which seems really, really small, but in fact it's a D that would be relevant to the left end of the spidogram, and it goes down like this. Okay, so it's really basically a disaster. You really very effectively strip everything out of the residue. So why do you care? Well, we think, for example, that the upper mantle has been depleted over time by melt extraction. Well, on the other hand, the upper mantle is still giving us basalt. So whatever we did to it, we had to leave significant component of basalt plus all the trace elements that we need. So it's pretty clear that you haven't extracted a lot of melt in a fractional melting sense from the upper mantle, otherwise there'd be nothing left. Okay. So we can easily just ignore whether we're doing batch or fractional, as long as we're looking at the melts. If we want to know what the mantle looks like, then we have to be really careful. Abby? I mean, one of the problems at very low melt fraction, you have a grain size of order 3 millimeters, let's say, in a mantle rock. And at when you've got a few tenths of a percent melt, you're talking about maybe 100 micron grain boundary melt network. And the fractional melting equation says that the melt is at every instant is in equilibrium with everything. At the same time, you're taking stuff out dramatically fast. So how does this happen? You know, how does it keep up? I think it's clear that in some melting situations it doesn't.
And
yep. You can be basically zoning, in my opinion, zoning the crystals as you take melt out, because there's simply not enough time to do complete equilibrium. It gets even worse than that, because once you imagine melt aggregating into channels, and the channels get large enough that the velocity gets high, then this melt, what do you call this melt? If you take it out immediately, put it on the surface, then it's fine. It's sort of looking back to the source. If it's percolating and sort of halfway equilibrating with stuff that's already been melted on the way up, then you're basically taking all the constraints off and you have no idea what's going on. Yeah. It's a horrible thing to think about, and none of us think about it, because you'd be totally stuck. Oh, the equations are easy, okay, but they depend on this. Which unfortunately is called D. and so to make the equations tell you something, I mean, it's easy to write the equations, make them tell you something, you have to know this for all these elements that you're worried about in all of these phases as a function of, strongly function of T, okay, because of the Arrhenius law, some function of P, function of stress state of the mineral. I mean, it just, the complexity goes up to the point that
people have addressed it. I mean, the back to the first paper that Dan McKenzie wrote before, one of the first things we did was evaluate whether you were in the limit where you could assume that the melt was staying would be solid as a hydrant. We decided that you were close, but there's yet another, but then Spiegelman and Kenyon did a paper where they give the equations for what you need to do in order to evaluate this. It is, but there's yet another issue, and that is that it's not just that the grains are static and there's diffusion in and out of them. Okay? In any melting region, you're forming solid as you're producing the melt. And actually, my view of what the equilibration rate is either going to be the diffusion equilibration rate if the diffusion is very fast, or if the diffusion is slow, it's going to go like a strain rate, because the grain boundaries are moving through the crystal at about the strain rate. And if the strain rate's on the order of 10 to minus 14 or 13 per second, you're going to equilibrate the crystals pretty rapidly. So,
strain
rate is like you can put stuff in the models. It's not bad something in my view, it's probably better than going through the whole thing while we're trying to figure out how far away, how to do it.
I mean, I think we know enough about diffusion coefficients. I'll show you some next lecture. But for things like the light rare earths in clinopyroxene, for example, they're unbelievably slow. So the whole concept of equilibrium, I mean, it's absolutely clear that while you may start in equilibrium at the very bottom, at the highest temperature, somewhere on its trip, this melt is going to lose touch. And when it loses touch, it will lose touch at different places depending on which element and which diffusion coefficient. So at that point, truly, we don't think about it. Okay.
The only point is that those equations, I mean, whether or not you know the diffusion coefficients exactly, what you do know is that they're really slow, and that those equations look very, very different for slow coefficients.
Absolutely.
And so I'm just wondering why those aren't your starting models.
No, I mean, people have written out the full equations pretty carefully. But there's so many, you've just added so many free parameters, unknown parameters, that you can no longer do anything. And so, you can either have an exact equation, which you can't use. Okay, I mean, I think we're all faced with this all the time. There's a whole lot more depth to this, okay? I'm just trying to show you that to go from the melts that we observe, we don't care about the melts, okay? What we really want to know is what the mantle looks like. There's this melting operator, and it's a black box, and in an ideal world, we could deal with it pretty easily. In a real world, it gets way more complicated. So whenever you try to make statements about the mantle source, you need to think about how well you've used this melt operator. So there's another way to look at it. And what I've said was there aren't many mantle samples available for our interrogation. But there's one class that has been used recently to good effect, okay, to look at, well, we could look, for example, at the composition of the bulk earth. And let me show you, this is based on mantle samples. Abyssal perditites are things that are dredged in the oceans, they're exposed on transform faults, sometimes exposed on graben faults in slow spreading ridges and so forth. So anyway, there you can dredge out there, and occasionally you find mantle, sub ridge mantle that's exposed. Okay, it's been through a recent melting process, unfortunately, okay, during its upwelling, before it got to the point where it was exposed. It had all this mid-ocean ridge basalt taken out of it. So it's pretty severely depleted, and it's going off on one of these lines. But the power of the equations, especially, I guess, while the melting equations are complicated, in the most simplest case, the residue, if it's a fractional melting residue, is simpler, okay? So what can we do? We take these abyssal peridotites, measure the trace element composition. If you were to look at spidergrams for these guys, where this is bulk earth, look at spidergrams for abyssal peridotites, they form this field. Okay, each one of these would be, this whole field is full of spidergrams. This would be a mildly depleted sample. This would be a dramatically depleted sample. You could go in and pick for example a couple of elements and just ask what is the relationship between those two elements in terms of this melting model. Well, we have this equation here, wherever it is, this guy here, which is the residue of modal fractional melting. Well, then it turns out if you take this data on peridotites, it's a little more complicated than that, okay, but because these things are really junky rocks and there are ways around that. And just plot a log-log diagram, okay, to take care of this power law. Plot the concentrations in a whole bunch of abyssal peridotites. And the formulation tells you that the depletion line on which this data will fall should be linear, log-log linear. Okay, so if we were to look at the data, so there are some abyssal peridotites that have only been mildly depleted during the melting process contemporaneous with their tectonic exposure, and others that have been drastically depleted. And this is about 7 orders of magnitude. Okay, just enormous, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can find almost this whole thing in one dredge area. And what it tells you is that during the melting process, before these got exposed tectonically, the melt extraction is very heterogeneous in space. That there are some areas where you've been very successful in getting an enormous amount of melt out, and there are other areas for some reason, you know, presumably this is all more or less isothermal. Is however big a box you want to look at. So it must have something to do with the melt extraction system, that it leaves little islands of stuff.
So it's a melting triangle that you sort of spotty.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, on a you know, sort of a scale of this room, I imagine there being little islands of stuff that don't have a vein close to them. They've melted a little bit, but I don't know the answer to that. Maybe.
I mean, the best guess at the moment is due to the channel belt. And of course, when you see exposures of you see that there's very strong, I'll show you some of the pictures.
Thank you.
Okay, so what can we do with this? If it's truly a simple melt extraction line, okay, that the process is described by this equation, and there's nothing funny going on, the implication is clear that C0, okay, this thing you started with, has to be on this line someplace. Okay? And you can get a lot of information out of this line directly. One thing, the slope, if we call it R, is the ratio of the partition coefficients. Again, these are small relative to 1. So basically, the slope is directly the ratio of the two partition coefficients. Okay, well, that's really pretty interesting information. The intercept is a function of the ratio of the two concentrations, you know, to raise to the power R. Well, we know what R is from the slope. So we, in effect, have determined both the two partition coefficients and the ratio of the two C0s. Now, so we would, if we knew one C0, if we knew either C0, we'd know everything. And this is like magic, because then you can take the spidergram and develop the whole spidergram for this manifold source. Okay. The problem is, how do you know where to stop? Okay, in other words, how do you pick a value?
Well, that's one problem. The other problem is that...
Well, I have a solution for that problem, but that's right.
I'm pretty sure the fact that you've got a log plot in 7 orders of magnitude, it's not as good as the tip of that line is very precise with regard to where you're.
It's actually, it's incredibly precise. You have to do it, but if you do two-error regression on this, the uncertainty in the slope is of order less than 1%. I mean, it's just scary, even though the scatter is pretty significant. I don't seem to be able to get this thing to be quiet. Anyway, you can do the statistics and convince yourself. So, okay, where do we stop? Yeah? Yes.
So you assume the salt is homogeneous.
Correct.
How good is the
assumption? Okay. Think about if the source was heterogeneous, how did you make it heterogeneous? Well, in the case of the upper mantle, which is what we're talking about, it probably is heterogeneous, okay? And it was made heterogeneous a long time ago by taking out little bits of melt. So in effect, the process of making it heterogeneous and the process of depleting it recently are the same as far as that equation goes. So they'll still define a line that goes through all the possible compositions of the heterogeneous source that you started with. Okay, you're absolutely right that you might have a bunch of sources that came into this system heterogeneous to begin with, but the chances are they'll be on that line. So the issue is, I mean, I think the issue is, how do you figure out where to stop? Let me just show you two answers to that. One, if I pick these, does this bother anybody besides me? No?
Fine.
Driving me nuts. Okay, I picked these two elements in particular because remember we talked about chondrites and the aggregation of the earth. We said that typically the refractory elements in chondrites are the same for all classes of chondrites. And for samarium neodymium, and This is a weight ratio. And I think Don mentioned this as well. Now, because the analytical techniques are really, really good for this, and you can look at, people have looked at many, many tens of chondrite, and I would say within 1% we know that. Okay, how do we use that? On this, this line here does not have a slope of 1. Okay, it has a slope that's the partition coefficients. On a log-log diagram, a slope of 1 will, you can fix a line of slope 1 to give you that ratio, and it looks like this. I may actually have this upside down, but and you'd have a whole class of lines. Etc. So if you think bulk earth is this, like chondrites, this fixes a line in space. You've already fixed this line in space. So this gives you bulk earth. Samarium and neodymium. Not just the ratio, it gives you the absolute concentrations. In fact, we had estimates from a variety of things of bulk earth for large parts of the spidogram. When you do it this way, you get almost exactly the same answers that McDonough and Son published in 1995. Okay, so I'm not, in this case, I've used this trick, if you like, to get bulk earth. We could also use it to get the composition of the upper mantle. Which is what we really want, okay? But there's one step further because we don't know the samarium, the neodymium of the upper mantle. Okay. All we do is we measure all these rocks. None of them have the samarium, the neodymium of their source. So we use an isotope trick because we do know the neodymium isotope ratio of the upper mantle. And this sort of transitions into how we use isotopes to constrain parent-daughter ratios. Again, I picked this pair in particular because samarium is radioactive, 147, decays to a radiogenic neodymium daughter. So we need to think, so we're going to now migrate into isotope evolution. But there is one principal thing that we've sort of assumed underlying all of this. We take a box of mantle, and it's made up out of 5 phases. Okay. We talked about the partitioning between these phases and melt. At the same time, obviously, there's partitioning between the different phases. Okay, that's built in. Once you know all the melt solid phase partition coefficients, you can calculate all the inter-phase, solid phase partition coefficients, or you measure them directly, whatever. Okay. So CPX, OPX, let's say neodymium, will have some partition coefficient between them. These are pretty similar in partition coefficient. So this partitioning is different by, well, the absolute values are different by quite a bit. The relative values are not terribly different, 20 or 30%. We talked about this problem of how you melt this at equilibrium because this box came from really deep in the mantle, really high temperature. And from the measured diffusion coefficients, and the fact that this box has been deep in the mantle for a long time, we know that these phases start in equilibrium with respect to trace elements. Okay, that's fundamental assumption seems to be fine. So as this box comes up adiabatically, at least you start with everything being in equilibrium. What about, okay, with respect to this whole spidergram, what about the isotopes? Let's focus on this. You remember this is the daughter of 147 samarium. This is the reference isotope. How is, we know neodymium will partition between these phases. And let's say if it's 0.1 here, it'll be 0.01 here. In other words, it'll be 10 times higher in CPX than OPX. How do you imagine the neodymium isotope ratio will partition? It's a trick question. Pardon? Same, exactly. Okay. Again, because neodymium at diffusion rate of neodymium at deep mantle temperatures is really fast, all of these will have, even though neodymium is different concentration, they all have the same value for this. And for average mid-ocean ridge basalts, just to give you a number, it's a number like that, okay? So the nice thing about isotopes then is when you start melting this, you go through this melting operator, operators, plural, because you don't know really which one is relevant, and all the issues we talked about with kinetics and stuff, okay, which makes it really hard to calculate your way through that melting operator. This stuff goes through the melting operator without even knowing it, okay? There's nothing you can do in the partial melting interaction with the country rock, whatever you like. If you expose the melt to a different isotopic composition on the way up, of course you can change it. But fundamentally, it's ignorant of the details of the melting process. And so this is incredibly powerful because it lets you just skip this whole complex box. Right?
Then, of course, all stable isotope chemistry relies on that ratio being different in different things. And
yeah.
Wouldn't this ratio be slightly different to the amount of digits that you're putting out?
Yes, but, okay. Well, okay, here's the way it works. Just for example, neodymium has a whole bunch of isotopes that are stable. And if you could measure them accurately, you would probably find that they were different in different minerals. Problem is when you actually measure this in the lab, this ratio, the machine that you measure it on fractionates it like crazy. I mean, it's not difficult to change that number by 0.5%. But in the process of changing that number, you also change that number by twice as much, because it's two mass units instead of one. This is a canonical constant in the solar system, at least in all of the materials that have ever been looked at. It appears that this ratio doesn't vary. So in the lab, we correct the number that's slightly screwed up from the machine to make this ratio all the same, and we all adopt the same value for this. And so, in fact, if there is natural variation superimposed on this radiogenic decay, you just correct it. And in a sense, you're correcting it as if you're going back to the beginning and where everything was the same. This is an important point. And 20 years ago, there were papers being written by petrologists calling us isotope geochemists radical freaks because everybody knew that you could fractionate stable isotopes, so why couldn't you fractionate this? And you know, our answer is, well, we know that it happens to us all the time. But we figured out, and every element, every radiogenic element has enough isotopes to do this with, okay, except lead. And fortunately, lead, the variations, the radiogenic variations are so large relative to the experimental variations that this is not yet an issue.
There is a spectral effect. The ratios in the 144 and all the other problems, they would be a massive fraction.
Okay, what I want to do now is, first I'm going to tell you the answer to this problem. Not for bulk earth, but for the upper mantle. Instead, we know this, and we know that the upper mantle got this way by some evolution path, which is based on its parent to daughter ratio. Okay, and I'll show you in a minute the nuts and bolts of that, but let me just tell you that we can convert this through a model into this, which we can then pick the line on here that has the right samarium-neodymium ratio. Okay, and thereby determine the actual composition of this thing we call the depleted Mohr mantle. I just refer to it as DMM, upper mantle. From the neodymium isotopes, you go through a model, evolution model, to determine today's samarium neodymium ratio in the upper mantle, which is a one-to-one line on here. And the intersection gives you the concentration of neodymium and samarium in the upper mantle, and then thereby basically the whole spidergram. So this spidergram that I drew, so in effect we've done two things using abyssal peridotites. We've fixed the bulk earth line and we've fixed this upper mantle line with this small problem of how we go from here to here. And that's what I want to talk about for the next 10 minutes or so. Now, there are a whole bunch of radiogenic isotope systems, and I was going to give you all the half-lives and R0s and the whole thing, but maybe what they've been doing is scanning my lecture notes and putting them on the web. So if the process of scanning doesn't completely obliterate this, it'll be there. But let me just write the general equation. That you can use for everything. This says now, okay. There's some embedded things in this that are algebraically simple, but conceptually a little tricky. Geochemists, for some reason, I guess because we think the Earth is 4.53 billion years old, we start counting back in time and count forward, sort of instead of counting from forward to back. It's backwards from the way you would, a conventional person would do it. So this is some isotope ratio. Pardon?
It has logic. If you want to start with two things that you actually measure and you can observe, unfortunately, you can only observe them now. You can't make a measurement.
I mean, when you're doing bulk Earth evolution, you'd think today would be 4.533 billion years, right? But it isn't. It's zero. I guess it's the, you know, the Eurocentric view of life. Okay, I don't really want to spend a lot of time because it's pretty straightforward, but let me just show you quickly. Do this differently. All we're doing is saying, you have a certain amount of 87 strontium, just as the example, initially. It doesn't matter what time or whatever. And it gets a contribution from the decay of rubidium according to this half-life. Okay. If you're really looking from beginning to end, then this T is today, okay, is zero. So this thing goes out, becomes one. So we could say either lambda T minus 1. So we're decaying this rubidium, making more strontium, and the strontium today is just the sum of what you started with plus what you made. Now, because of this problem of difficulty of measuring absolute amounts of anything, you divide this through by this a stable isotope. So now we're measuring an isotope ratio, which we can measure 10 to the third times better. So today, the 87-86 ratio is equal to 87-86 ratio initially, plus the decay term now, and this is the parent-daughter. Okay, so it's samarium, neodymium, rubidium, strontium, uranium, lead. These are the parent-daughters. By convention, we call those mu. In general, the other tricky thing is the way the equation's been written and massaged is this mu is today's mu. You realize that over time this decays. So the parent-daughter ratio is actually a function of time. Okay? And the longer it goes on, the smaller this number gets. So the convention is simply to always characterize mu today. And you know what the decay of this looks like. It's just E lambda, E minus lambda T. So that's not a problem to make sure this is always today's ratio. And when you start modeling the early Earth, you can really get wound up if you try to put in the initial rubidium strontium ratio. You'll just go nuts. Okay. Just take my word for it. Okay, so we've got this equation. And this is totally general, and all you need to know are the half-lives, and you pick whatever parent daughter you want to do a model, and you pick an R0. So let's talk just a little bit about sort of how this evolution goes, and just draw you some pretty pictures. Now, people will do this to you. This is like the petrologist. You know, there's two ways of plotting PT diagrams. One is this, which just drives me nuts. And the other is this. Okay, pressure increases down and so forth. Anyway, I'm sort of stuck on this one because time is increasing this way, okay, even though it doesn't look like it. Okay. Yes, we could go make it one step more confusing. When Claude Allègre does his graphs, he wants to make them linear. Okay. Now, technically, the half-lives for most of these guys are so long that they look linear to the eye. But to be a perfectionist, he doesn't plot t here. He plots lambda t, or e to lambda t. So now, just for illustration, we use strontium because it sort of illustrates a number of things. We need to know the initial ratio, okay, what the Earth had for strontium when it started. Well, we don't know that because we don't have any original Earth. Okay. So what happens is they, by convention again, they picked the lowest 8786 ever measured in anything in the solar system as the starting point. Okay, well, that's probably a good starting point. The problem is rubidium-strontium ratio of chondrites is way higher than the rubidium-strontium ratio of bulk Earth. And that's simply because when the Earth was accreted, rubidium is a volatile element and it did not accrete the way it should. So a lot of it got left behind. So there's a little messy piece here. The age I just plotted, gave you, if you remember, was the age of core formation. Okay, because that came from the hafnium tungsten. Well, what relevance is that to the rubidium strontium system? There's no relevance. Okay, well, what is of relevance? Really, we should start back here at 4.567, which is the age of the actual material that gave this value. Okay, we'll take that off. And this is accurate. But because of this high rubidium-strontium ratio in chondrites, you start growing strontium like that. Okay, well then, by the time you accreted the Earth is deficient in rubidium, so the trajectory takes a right-hand turn. Okay, but we don't really know, since we don't know we know the age of core formation, we don't really know the age sort of when accretion was well along. We don't really know this little gap. So there's a missing piece here, and it's changing really rapidly. So this is a long way of telling you that we actually don't know what R0 is for the bulk Earth. Little problem. And we're going to make believe it's there just for the sake of argument, but realize it isn't. Now, in another system like the exact opposite thing is true, okay? Uranium lead ratio of chondrites is way less than the uranium lead ratio of the silicate Earth. Notice I said silicate Earth. Okay, and the reason for that is we presume, we don't know this, lead is a volatile element, so it's possible the Earth just didn't accrete as much lead as it should have. But we also imagine lead being siderophile may go into the core. So there is, if we were to plot this as a lead isotope diagram, we would start at the beginning, okay, the end of nucleosynthesis. Chondrites basically have a very, very low uranium-lead ratio, so nothing happens. And then when you separated the core, that 4534, then this guy takes off. So this is a little tidier because at least, since you don't know this time, but you do know nothing happened. Okay. So there's some uncertainty in the beginning, which we will ignore. Now once we show the evolution diagrams, you could imagine ways to determine this value from terrestrial analysis. Okay, you could go back, for example, to the very earliest rocks and try to find ones that didn't have much rubidium and measure the strontium and so forth. Unfortunately, the very earliest rocks have been through almost every episode of Earth tectonism since, and so they're really murky, really nasty rocks. So we don't know what today's bulk Earth is, but let's say it's 7047. Now there are reasons to think this. So there are a whole bunch of ways basically to get from here, R0, to here. I mean, the simplest, if you had a piece of Earth that had never had anything done to it, and namely it was really a bulk Earth reservoir, just do it like that, okay? And this slope, the slope on this diagram is the parent-daughter ratio. And that is a number like 0.03. Not that that matters, but it will in a minute. Okay. So we have other reservoirs on Earth. One of them is this guy down here, which is the upper mantle. And so there are a number of ways to get to that. Okay, you could get to it in one shot. You could say early on, because the Earth accreted without its full complement of rubidium, maybe there are parts of it that are accreted with way less rubidium and they've survived untouched and they just grow directly to here. But we don't think they would survive. So this doesn't seem like a rational way to do it. Now, in a sort of historical sense, people went from what I call a one-stage model to a two-stage model. Okay, it's really, you make it more complicated simply by saying you grow the Earth as a bulk system for a while and then you do something to it and you make another reservoir. And the sort of first order model for the upper mantle, as I've told you, is that it's a bulk Earth that you've taken over time, taken out continental crust, leaving behind a depleted residue. Well, the sort of first order, you could say, if the age, average age of continental crust is 3 billion, 2.5 billion years, then you could look at it in very simplistically as a two-stage model, where you take all the crust out, and of course the crust goes off this way because it has all the rubidium that you took out of the upper mantle. Well, but we're pretty sure that continental crust has grown over time. Therefore, the depleted mantle must have grown depleted over time. So a better approximation is to basically make this a continuous process. So you depart from bulk Earth early on, take a little continental crust out. And it, you continually sense the slope on here as a rubidium-strontium ratio. Continually through time, then you're decreasing the rubidium-strontium ratio. Then the complement to that is that you take crust out every, all along the way. You don't know exactly whether you're taking it out of bulk earth each time, or whether you're simply taking out of this first and then mixing it up. Okay, so we don't know the details of that. But we have three different ways of arriving here. We can go straight, we can go two-stage, or we can go continuous. And the reason that's sort of important is your idea about rubidium strontium in the upper mantle today clearly depends on how you got there. I mean, that's obvious, okay? If you got there as a single stage, and this looks a little curved to me, okay, you have the slope of this. If you got there as a two-stage process, the slope is this. Continuous process, probably something in between. So there is one number that's really, really firm. And okay, we don't really know the details of how we got there, but there's one number that you can set an absolute time limit with, okay? And that's, somebody might say, oh, I believe the upper mantle was depleted 1 billion years ago. You know, that nothing happened for a long time, and we just, 1 billion years ago, we had this catastrophic event and depleted the upper mantle from bulk earth. Okay. Well, can you do that? 1 billion years ago, there's bulk earth. We've already passed the upper mantle strontium isotope value. Okay. So a limit, absolute limit, to when you had to start working on this depletion is this value projected back until it hits the bulk earth line. And that turns out to be whatever it is. ₹1.64 billion. So very crudely, there's an absolute limit. This is a model age in a sense, because you're saying if we were to make the upper mantle out of bulk earth, we had to do some of it before 1.64 billion years. Now, geochemists have lots of numbers about when the earth did this and when the earth did that, and they're always kind of slightly iffy, and they're really hard to describe to a geophysicist, because they'll go, wow, that's... You really know it that well? Well, no, we don't know it at all. But but it's things like this. This is a model age, but it's like, it's really important to be able to set any limit whatsoever and sort of feel good about it. Bruce?
I was going to say, can you do better than that, because if you measure this sample, it has
the... Oh, you can't. So you can't measure that sample, because then we're back to this problem. You've got the black box melt operator. Yeah, you can measure rubidium strontium in MORBS. And as long as you say rubidium is more incompatible than strontium, you could say that the rubidium strontium ratio you measure in the melt is an upper limit to the source it came from. But, you know, it's, in fact, what we do to measure rubidium in this upper mantle spidergram, since you can't measure rubidium in abyssal peridotites, okay, this part of the spidergram, you can't do this sort of trick I did. We use this number, use a continuous evolution model to determine that number, and then we use that to plug into the spidergram. I know it's not tidy. Okay, I think we better stop and Next time I'll continue this kind of story, but going into helium-3, since everybody knows helium-3 is the marker for primordial mantle. I'll tell you why that's not true. Thanks.